From the LifeWord studios, this is Life Perspectives with Michael Goring.
Joining me today is the president of Apologetics, Inc., Michael C. Sherrard. Michael, great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us for this important discussion on apologetics.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Michael. Good to meet you and glad to be here.
So Mike, you're the president of Apologetics, Inc. What inspired you to pursue a career in apologetics, and how did you get started in the field?
The long and the short of it is that it really bothers me when I see people being robbed of abundant life because they're falling for lies. Mm. Satan's been in the business of deceiving men and women forever, and it's always with the promise of abundant life. Forsake God and his ways, and you will be happy. And we live in a world today where those lies come in so many forms. And I see apologetics as a tool to show people why Christianity is true, why it is good, why it is beautiful, and in Jesus Christ is the deepest satisfaction that you could ever experience. And so I've been a Christian for basically my entire life. I did not have a crisis of faith. So my turning to apologetics as a discipline, if you will, was so that I had a tool set with which I could use to help people find the abundant life that they were created for.
Yeah. And to me, we live in a world, as you said, and we're pursuing everything that we can to find happiness and satisfaction, and yet it leaves us empty. How would you define relational apologetics? Why is it so crucial to the approach of defending the Christian faith?
Yeah, so that was the first book that I wrote, and I wrote it, gosh, when I started writing, it was almost maybe 20 years ago. I know I don't look that old. Thank you for that. and at the time, I was a high school teacher, and I was finishing my master's of divinity in concentration in apologetics. And I was at a private Christian school, and I kept getting asked all of these questions about, you know, can you trust the Bible? How can you believe in a good God when there's so much suffering? And so I initially set out to write kind of an introductory book on apologetics. But as soon as I got into the writing, one of the things that I experienced was there's actually a growing body of apologetic literature. And in the last 20 years, there's kind of been a boom in that. There's a lot of books out there answering some really important questions. But one of the things that I saw that there was a problem was there was a disconnect between the information that we're absorbing and the conversations that we're then able to have. And so relational apologetics was written to give people a method for effective conversation about really important issues. So it's not a book necessarily on when they say this, how do you prove them wrong? It's more about how do you develop healthy relationships where your authentic holiness can be on display. You learn how to have good conversations and build good relationships. And in that context, seek to grow in knowledge so you can provide meaningful answers to the honest questions your friends will have. Because I do believe that it's an act of love to be able to show somebody why the Bible is reliable. Apologetics isn't just about beating somebody up or winning an argument. It's about lovingly giving somebody an answer to an honest question they have as they're in a journey to faith in Jesus Christ.
Yeah. You mentioned the book Relational Apologetics. In the book, you emphasize defending the faith with holiness, with respect, with truth. How can Christians embody these principles while navigating difficult or sometimes controversial conversations?
Yeah, well, I think the first step for those of us that have the desire to show that Christianity is true is we must live it out. Mm. So repentance is like the first step in apologetics in my mind. And repentance is a practice of the righteous, not the pagan. It's not something you just do once. It's a lifetime practice where you're constantly reorienting your life to follow Jesus and to strive to live as he lived. Each day, kind of leaning towards Jesus and away from the sinful patterns of this world. So, you know, following Jesus and living an authentic Christian life is an apologetic because it displays the goodness of Jesus Christ. So I would seek to do that. Upon that foundation, learn how to listen. A lot of times we think we got to give everybody the answer. Well, answers are good, but they're only relevant when you know what someone's actual question is, not what their talking point is. Yeah. So I think a good, upon a foundation of holiness in your life, a good practice for an evangelist or an apologist is just to listen, have people tell their stories. Ask, what do you mean by that? How did you come to that belief? Do you think that's all there is to the story? So listen and ask good questions. And in so doing, you'll get a pretty clear understanding of what a person's actually dealing with. That's the respect piece, right? Holiness, respect, and truth, respect other people. And when someone feels respected, they're much more open to listening to the truth you then can present. So I think that is the order. So the subtitle was written in kind of the order, the way I think it should go. Have a holy lifestyle upon which you develop authentic relationships where you listen and learn about what somebody is stumbling, what they're wrestling with, what their stumbling block is. And then in that context, offer the truth that you know.
Yeah. In your book, Why You Matter, you argue that the quest for meaning is ultimately meaningless without God. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. Can you elaborate on why you believe a Christian worldview provides the most coherent answer to life's biggest questions?
Yeah, and what I mean by the quest for meaning is meaningless, I mean that kind of in an objective way.
Sure.
And if God does not exist, life is here as a result of a cosmic accident. There is no reason why there is something other than nothing beyond chance. And if that's the case, what follows, and this is kind of atheism 101, I'm not misrepresenting an atheist position here. What follows is that life does not have any inherent meaning. Human life does not have intrinsic value. We got here through the same random process as a cockroach did. So what makes human life more valuable than the cockroach? And how can we pursue a meaningful life? It's arbitrary.
Yeah.
And you have to construct for yourself your own meaning. Right and wrong would be purely subjective. And so in that sense, how do you live out a meaningful life? You know, the atheist kind of idea, and even what Satan was presenting in the garden here, it's like, you know, if there is no morally binding law for us to follow, then there's this certain kind of freedom, right? Just go do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Just don't hurt somebody else. But if there's no way you, like, if there's no wrong, in that sense, just whatever, what really is right? And what really would be success in that environment? Real quick story, if I can tell you, I'll tell it to you
maybe a
minute and a half. I was giving a lecture on this, on the title, on that topic of how the quest for meaning is meaningless without God. And afterwards, a young college student comes up, bright young girl, she was an atheist. And afterwards she says, you know what? I'm really tracking with you and I think you're right. I think you're right. If God doesn't exist, there are no moral laws. There are no rights. There are no wrongs. Just kind of, we have to put it together best we can. And it's really freeing. She said, life can be so stressful ever since you can talk. People are asking you, what are you going to do with your life? Have you joined this cause? Have you joined this club? How are your grades? What school are you getting into? She's like, the thought that nothing really matters, just find what makes you happy and just do it. She said, it can be very freeing. But then she goes, but you know what? On the other hand, it would be kind of nice to know that what I was pursuing was something greater than simply the fulfillment of my own preferences. So she saw the relative meaninglessness in that. Like at the end of the day, if there is no meaning, if there is no God, what have I done with my life? I've simply accomplished fulfilling personal subjective desires. And is that really meaningless? And I don't think it is. And a lot of even young people like that, young atheists, see it the same way.
Yeah. What do you think is the greatest challenge that as Christians that we face when it comes to engaging the culture, a secular culture? I mean, that story is a great example of some challenges that we as Christians face in trying to articulate in a winsome and meaningful way the truthfulness, the reliability of the gospel. I don't know where those thumbs up are coming from, but anyway.
Yeah, I'll take it, man. You're digging this conversation.
Yeah. So what do you think is the greatest challenge Christians face when it comes to engaging the secular culture?
You know, this may sound funny. I actually think it's that we, either we don't know very many non-believers. Christians can tend to be isolated.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people work from home these days, or if you go into your work environment, you go in, you do your job, you come home, you got your sports, and I mean, we're just isolated, and our churches are very isolated. And I think a lot of Christians don't know that many non-believers. And if they do, it's superficial. So this busyness that we have and the depth of relationships that we have with non-believers, I think is a really profound challenge. So one of the solutions to that involves the way our churches even conceive of themselves and how they should schedule programming and things like that, but also for families' expectations and their weekly schedule. How much time should I carve out to create space where I could invite a neighbor over for dinner and get to know them and get to know what they actually believe? So in modern life, we're becoming very tribal, you know, we're isolated, and we reduce people that aren't like us to the ideologies we think they hold. And it's easy to hate an ideology. And there are some ideologies that you should hate because they are so vile. The problem, though, in this kind of tribal, isolated modern culture that we're living in, or postmodern, whatever, we then reduce these people to the ideology we think they hold. And it's easy for hatred to emerge. You break that down over the dinner table by inviting people into your home, again, listening and asking questions. And within that, both your love for your unsaved neighbor grows, the insight into why they're not a follower of Jesus grows, they're able to see how your family, what it looks like as a follower of Jesus. And in that environment, man, you get to tell the powerful story of how Jesus has changed your life and then begin helping to answer any questions that they may have. So I think that's one of the greatest challenges. It's not simply that, oh, all these Christians are so stupid, they can't give a lecture on the reliability of the Bible. It's like, even if they could, they don't have an audience to give it to because they don't know anybody. So I think that's the greatest challenge. And if the church could pivot a bit here, right? And we're really good at building programs, but could we build communities where we have people invited into our home? Sorry, you were going to say something.
Well, no, just on that, what would be some ways that you would recommend that churches potentially pivot?
I think one of them is just by looking at the calendar and looking at how many things are programmed within the church life. There becomes kind of this pressure within church culture of this is what it means to live as a Christian. And the vision you're presented is, I'm at this Bible study, I'm at this service, I'm serving in this program, and it's very building-centric. And so you think about, I've got my 9-to-5 job, I've got my family obligations, I've got times that I need for leisure with myself, I've got my obligations to my church. It's almost like, where do I even have time in my schedule now to have any obligations to my neighbors? And so I think that's one way where healthy churches that maybe even have really good programs, it may be that some of those programs need to be sacrificed so that people have the schedule opportunity to be present in the communities and the neighborhoods that they live. And if a church had that vision, it's interesting how that might alter their vision for their programs, where maybe some of these programs need to be empowering and equipping so that the person that's like, heck no, I'm not going to invite my neighbor to my house. Well, maybe you have a program that helps give them the vision and some basic tools that they could use in doing something like that.
Yeah. It's a great, great, great perspective on how we can better engage and kind of curve and conquer that challenge of engaging with unbelievers in the context of our spheres of influence. I mean, our just think about our neighbors. How many mm-hmm. of us actually talk to our neighbors? You're currently working on a doctorate in ethics. Is that right?
Man, don't bring that up. Yes. Okay. I am working on it. All I have to do is write my dissertation and it's drowning me.
I do want to talk about it though.
that's fine. I'm kidding.
How does your academic focus on ethics inform your approach to apologetics and to the teaching of our faith?
I think one of the greatest stumbling blocks to Christianity right now is its perceived goodness. So a lot of the questions pertain to value. Can Christianity be good if it is oppressive to women? Isn't the Bible misogynistic? Doesn't the Old Testament condone slavery? Now, here's a bit of crossover between classic apologetics and theology and ethics. So, you know, in our time, we're so disciplined that we forget how things cross over between one another. But to your question, you know, ethics helps us to understand things like value and what is good, what makes something good. And there's just a lot of confusion over that because, again, we're living on the other side of the Enlightenment. One of the results of the Enlightenment was a rejection of the existence of God, but moreover, this thing called telos, which is a Greek idea. Telos would be the intrinsic purpose of a thing. And for most of Western civilization, we were guided by the belief that things have a purpose. Whether it's a stapler, which has an obvious purpose, right, to clip things together. And if a stapler has a purpose, the word good has something meaningful to say, right? A good stapler is a thing that functions according to its purpose. Mm-hmm. Well, if human beings don't have a telos, what are we supposed to do with our lives? So there's just this rampant chaos. And so into our time, so much of the confusion and how this becomes a stumbling block to Christianity centers around issues of morality, sexual ethics being one of the biggest ones right now. So, you know, my focus in my doctoral work was to gain a better understanding both of the history of ethical progression to understand better why we're in this state of moral confusion. And then my doctoral project is how to create a resource for the church so that they can teach the younger generations the basis of ethics so that they have a firm foundation to make moral decisions.
Yeah. I know you just talked about sexual ethics, and this may answer the question, but what ethical dilemmas do you believe that Christians are most likely to face in today's culture, and how can apologetics help us navigate those challenges?
Well, a lot of our work deals with the younger generations.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest questions they have, for example, is they know somebody that they would say is struggling with, this is their language, they're struggling with their identity. They are struggling with their gender identity. They're struggling with their sexual identity. This is the language that they'll use. And the young adults both go, I don't know what to think about it. I don't know what the Bible has to say about this. Or I kind of know what the Bible says to say about it, but how do I reconcile this with the goodness of God and my friend here, who they you know, sometimes accept some of these sound bites and culture of this person was born and made this way. So apologetics helps you to articulate well the biblical position on sexual ethics, answering questions of God's goodness along the way. And it also helps with the tools to have good conversation. Because here's the other part of the question is it's always, how do I talk to my friend who is struggling with transgenderism? Like, that's how the kids ask the question. Sometimes they'll just ask you, is it right or is it wrong? But it's always action, almost always action oriented. How do I talk to my friend who is? And so again, within apologetics, it's both kind of a skill set to help you diagnose what the stumbling block is. Go to scripture and philosophy to understand why something is wrong or right, and then have the conversational tools to be able to have a loving conversation to walk along somebody, helping them to pursue what is true, ultimately, again, to find the satisfying, abundant life that's only in Jesus Christ and his ways.
Yeah, that's good. How do you integrate your knowledge of ethics and apologetics when addressing contemporary issues like social justice, politics, bioethics? How do you do that?
Well, those are complicated subjects. And I think a great first principle is seek understanding before you critique. And that's not something most people follow.
Yeah.
On these issues, which are highly controversial, they touch us in some personal way. You know, we're quick to respond. We're quick to take a side, and we feel the moral pressure through social media to take a side, right? Like, you know, we live in the world today where everybody has a voice, And you're expected to say something, right? And if you don't, it's like, what's wrong with you? Why are you not taking a side? So we rush to judgment on these issues. And so when it comes to things like critical race, bioethics, you know, things like, you know, IVF, which of course has been around for a while, but these you know, highly complicated issues, first principle, seek understanding before you critique. And fortunately, we have a ton of resources this day. I mean, information age, which I know can be a little bit challenging because you go online, you're like, where the heck do I start? Which is why organizations like ours, Apologetic Inc., exists. We don't view ourselves as the, like, sitting in the chairs on high just to tell everybody what to think. We're really just a resource for the church to help them find good answers to these questions. So anybody listening to this, for example, and they want to get there, they're like, what do I do with critical race theory? Well, one, I'd say go to your pastor, but your pastor may not even feel like he's an expert in it because of all the duties that a pastor has. Your pastor can say, I don't know, why don't you reach out to literally Mike Sherrard and see if he can't point you in the right direction, because this is what we do. And we can, we've kind of filtered and can curate for you good places to go to begin growing in knowledge. So there's more to be said about your question, but I think that's a real practical first step on these issues, is just to seek understanding before you start criticizing anything.
Well, you know, and what I appreciate about you, Mike, is, well, first of all, I learned about you particularly through Summit Ministries in Manitou Springs. My oldest son is 17, and the last 2 years he's gone, and he has sat underneath your teaching and the teaching of other leading Christian apologists. And what I appreciate is the information that you're instilling in the next generation, and you know, they're the future of the church, and having resources like Apologetics Inc. and Summit, and I could go on to list J. Warner Wallace and there's a lot of great resources out there for those who are watching, for you to go and do that, the hard work of seeking understanding, as you said. What advice would you give someone who is interested in becoming more engaged in apologetics, particularly in their local community, in their church, or online through social media? What would be your advice to them?
Yeah, one is I would, like for people listening here, here's a couple of things. The first one is maybe a throwback to what we talked about earlier. Find somebody who's not a Christian and learn why they're not a Christian. And that will direct your apologetic inquiry. I think it's just really helpful to study apologetics in a practical way, not in an abstract way. Mm-hmm. And in a practical way would be, I have this friend who's a Muslim, and I don't know anything about Islam. So I'm going to learn everything I can from him. I'm going to find out why he's a Muslim. I'm going to find out what he thinks is wrong with Christianity. And then I'm going to go find the apologetic resources that can help me in my relationship there. And again, it's like, so what book on apologetics, you know, when it pertains to Islam, should I read? Where do I go? Again, just, I don't know how practical people think this is, but that's one simple way our ministry can help. Send us an email and say, hey, I've got a friend who's really struggling with the goodness of God and the problem of evil. Where could I start? What kind of book should I read? We'll real quick email, send it to you back. Or, hey, check out J. Warner Wallace. He's got a great video on this. And we can begin introducing you to some of the trustworthy sources in the apologetics realm. So I would just do that. First, I would befriend someone who's not a follower of Jesus, learn why they're not. That can guide you in the kind of apologetics material you are studying. And if you have any questions about where to start on something like that, just shoot us an email, find us on social media or whatnot, and we'll give you a tip on where to go.
Yeah, that's great. Great advice. In your speaking and in your teaching, what are some of the most frequent questions that you encounter about Christianity?
Yeah, the big, it would be, here's the broad category, is God good?
Yeah.
And that's probably not, I'm not going to say that's the number one, but it's within my top five. Is God good? And that question comes in a lot of different ways. It could be theological. How is God good? Is hell real? If hell's real, is God good? Is God good? Could be coming from a questioning the Bible. Again, reading in the Old Testament, it's like, isn't the Old Testament pretty savage? How, is the God of the Old Testament different than the, is God good? So related to the Bible. Suffering produces those questions, right? And a lot of the young adults have suffered in some serious ways. Disability is another one. I have a son with a very rare genetic disorder. So is God good? Wrestling with the problem of evil is a question that's not just age specific, but the next generation is definitely asking that. They are asking, it's what's interesting, and I'll be careful to nerd out because I know we've got limited time here. But when I got started in apologetics, really about 20 years ago, questions about the Bible were mostly in the category of, is it true? Aren't there contradictions? Not that those questions have gone away, but what's really interesting is that there's a renewed interest in spiritual things right now. Bible sales are actually up 22% in this country. There's a shift in this religious landscape. New atheism has not won. The woke agenda actually is running out of steam, and the Enlightenment Project has failed. And there's a generation of seekers out there right now. And what they're doing is they're reading the Bible again. Before, they weren't even reading the Bible because they're like, oh, you can't trust it. It's what, but no, they're curious now and they're reading the Bible. And so a lot of their questions now are theological. And so one of the things I'm doing with our team is like, hey, you know, it's not like we don't need to still be ready to show from like a manuscript evidence why the Bible is trustworthy, but you better be up on your Old Testament right now because the kids are reading the Old Testament and they're going to be asking you all kinds of theological questions. And it's a genuine stumbling block for them when they're for example going through the book of Judges or certain stories in Genesis. And is polygamy, does the Bible condone polygamy? So those kinds of questions are emerging, which to me is cool and good and exciting. It's showing me that this next generation is opening the Bible again, but it's causing a lot of questions.
Yeah. That is encouraging, and it does give us our marching orders to be ready to give an account for the hope that is within us, as Peter calls us to. Mike Sherrard, thank you so very much for this engaging and thought-provoking conversation today. To find out more about Mike and to have helpful apologetic resources at your disposal, visit apologetics.org. I'm Michael Goring, and this has been Life Perspectives. Thanks for watching.